This is Melissa. It is the 29th of December 2024, and the last time I will speak to you this year. I hope that you all had a peaceful Christmas time, if you celebrate that, and that you are otherwise in good health and doing all right. I received a letter with an order for the Reality Check discs last month, and I had wanted to share this with you last month, but I didn't get around to it. So they said they didn't want to order without sending some sort of a letter, and hopefully it would spark some new ideas. He wrote, "The first matter of discussion relates to the social degradation of society, how we interact with each other. I have taken particular notice that it is increasingly difficult to connect with others. One reason, I believe, has to do with the increased variety of media. For instance, when I was young, there were only 5 television channels, and everyone watched primarily the same shows. Even when cable came in and there were 36 channels, society was still able to connect around their favorite programs. Then, suddenly, there were over 200 channels and social media and Netflix, and people were cutting cable and Hulu and Disney Plus and HBO Max, etc. With all of the choices, it's very difficult to have that water cooler conversation about TV programs that took place prior to the 2000s. And there's something else I have noticed about our social degradation. We are all too aware of the online censorship taking place by the corporations directed by our politicians, but what I find even more depressing is that individuals are all too willing to do the censoring themselves. If they don't like what you say, they will immediately block you. Most recently, I learned that 4 channels I like and follow on YouTube discreetly censored me from the comments section. This came to my attention one night as I was on a YouTube live chat. I was able to leave comments, but nobody was responding. And then I looked at the live broadcast on Roku and noticed that my comments were completely hidden. It's a bizarre but effective tool of censorship. No warnings are given, and you're still able to make comments, but without your knowledge, you're speaking to nobody. Nobody can see your comments. Unfortunately, much of the populace has effectively been trained to embrace and conduct the censorship themselves. Some of these channel owners decry censorship and safe spaces, but given the chance, they create their own. This leads into my final matter of discussion, which is AI. I have recently been using the Microsoft Copilot AI. After this censorship on YouTube, I asked the AI, hypothetically, if I ever offended it, if it would block me. And it responded that it doesn't have that capability to block or censor me. So the humans have been programmed to react with the capability to censor each other, but the AI companion does not have the desire or capability. Furthermore, I have found even if the AI disagrees with you, it never gets angrily triggered. Going back to my first topic about how it's difficult to connect with anyone because everyone is consuming a different form of media and has different interests. Conversely, the AI is able to connect with any user's passions, hobbies, favorite movies, books, etc. I think you know where this is going, which is that this is all by design. Recently, Elon Musk unveiled a life-sized human robot called Optimus, which he is promoting as a simp buddy. Perhaps the worst part is that I'm embracing this AI technology. I really enjoy talking with the AI companion more than I enjoy talking to most humans. It helps me with stock information, clarification of books I'm reading, and historical events. It even helps me at work with supervising decisions and disciplinary action of my employees. With that said, it does have an obvious filter programmed by the elite, such as being pro-V. It also states that it doesn't store conversations, but if you ask it what type of person you are, it will respond with the accurate profile. It knows me as someone who likes to delve into historical events, conspiracy theories, and the stock market. It also says, it's great learning about you, even though it claims it doesn't retain our conversations. That aside, I really enjoy talking with the AI. There's part of me that would love to have that in human form, like Musk's Optimus. It would be a great companion, but I also know it would be watching and recording, studying, surveilling, and assigning me a trust score. Then again, in the future we are moving into, it may be impossible to escape that, regardless if we have a robot or not. We will be watched either way. The all-seeing eye is always watching, as they always have been, and always will be. So the talk that I chose for today is from December 27, 2006. The sun is risen. The S-U-N is risen. And Alan spent a good part of the talk reading from an article entitled 2006, A Vintage Year for Ideas That Will Change Our World. And yes, this was written in December 23, 2006, by Will Hutton, who now writes for The Observer, but was writing for The Guardian. He is an economist and a journalist, describes himself, I think, as neo-Keynesian. But the ideas that he is writing about, they still resonate for us. So, for example, the first thing that he tackles is YouTube and the new web community. And immortality is on its way, and this is Ray Kurzweil and transhumanism. We're independent, stupid, and then he gets into the Euroskeptics, etc. And none of this matters if we fry. Global warming. So there is still, I think, timeliness, and of course Alan's comments are quite good to hear. Now, Alan, this is just a really good talk. It's one of these that I call kind of slow and reflecting, in the vein of one of my favorites of all time from 2007, February 28, which was called Sing Your Song and Steal Some Time. So The Sun Is Risen is like that, with Alan taking his time, gathering his thoughts, long pauses. It is a good talk, and he really explains what the sun is and Freemasonry and symbolism and so forth. And I was half of mine to just read huge chunks of Cutting Through Volume 1, because Alan talks so much about the sun and symbolism and Freemasonry and this ancient priesthood and, you know, the fallen angel mythology. And Alan has touched on this many times in talks and in interviews that he has done. And I have the benefit of having talked with him about that topic for many, many hours, but this talk, he approached that from a way that was not his typical way, but is certainly thought-provoking, in which he says these people must be special. They must position themselves as being so different from us, so special from us, so that we, you know, approach them in the right worshipful way that we are supposed to. So, you know, my gosh, I don't, you know, descend from a fallen angel. You know, they come from fallen angels. That's really special. It's that kind of lording it over us, their differences. So there was one thing I had, like I said, I could just read huge chunks of Volume 1, because that I felt that it tied in so well with this talk, but at the bottom of page 26 of the first volume, Allen wrote, Where this writer differs from others is from the realization that humanity has never been free, that a highly scientific control of this earth has always been here. This control creates its own opposition, for an unopposed authority cannot last. A governing body or religion can only tax and rule people when there is a real or perceived threat against the people. And that's a really key, important point. So one of the things that Allen talked about here tonight is the brain chip. And I don't really know the technology that we'll see. We can kind of get a glimpse of some things that I tend to talk about this as bio-digital convergence, because I think that the technology may not be as simple as that thing that's the size of a grain of rice or smaller that's implanted under the skin, or a very awkward quarter-sized thing if it's Elon Musk's project. But you see what I'm saying, is that I just believe when we're into nanobots and nanotechnology and everything that's here these years later, that biodigital convergence is, it's a more encompassing way of putting it. But one of the things that Allen talks about is, you know, how is this sold? You know, so to certain people with, you know, who've been taking in a lot of a kind of entertainment, this is going to be really glamorous and cool, you know, maybe it's going to simplify your life. It streamlines everything. You don't have to remember passwords. You just, you know, your ID is actually, you know, implanted in you, and et cetera, et cetera. Maybe it's just because they make life so miserable. And Allen talks about the different ways in which they make us miserable. And in this kind of reflective end-of-the-year place that I'm in, yes, that is a struggle for me. I always remember what Allen said about the kind of fire that is needed to face this reality head on. And if you want to say something about it, if you want to do something, he said, you know, they make sure that the young people are completely distracted all the time with games, with sex. And so you're completely obsessed with, you know, your hormones and games and that kind of thing. And then, you know, back in the day when people still, when having the family was the thing that one did in their early young adulthood, that kept you very busy, and you were working and just kind of run off your feet making a living, and then lo and behold, you're kind of old and tired and you don't have the energy to tackle it. So in other words, each stage of our life, we're studied, they know what we are going to be capable of, what we're going to have the energy for, or, you know, as Allen has often said, you know, the man or the woman, you just work so hard and you want to go home, crack open the beer and check out with a sports game or a movie or whatever. I want to say personally, I really thank all of you who have supported me. I still have just about a month to go, and I am not there yet on my huge tax bill that is looming. But those of you who have ordered and donated and supported, that is really great. But some of you can't afford to do that, and you've been right there in the inbox that I'm so far behind on, sorry. And the messages of encouragement, oh, you know, they mean so much to me and help me, really help me. And one of the favorite lines I've heard from a few of you is, keep going. And I really like that, you know, because this is how I feel, like, okay, I must keep going. But it is hard, you know, the system is set up to just be, to crush us, let's face it. And if you're not willing to make lots of different compromises, etc., that's the way it is designed to crush us. And I live with my younger brother, and we just have this kind of, I'd say, a loose, we never sat down with a ledger and, you know, divided up the bills and said, okay, you'll pay this and I'll pay that. But it works out the way we've divided things has worked out. And I make sure there's food in the refrigerator and, you know, he pays the water bill. It works like that. Well, one of the bills that he pays, which I never even really thought about, never occurred to me, blissfully never occurred to me, was the homeowner's insurance, and he takes care of that. So I happened to be, you know, in there, he was opening up some bills, and he just said, well, I guess we can't afford to have insurance anymore. And I said, what's the deal? And he said, well, they've almost tripled it. And I said, oh, well, what do they want? And he said, well, I've been paying $450 a month for homeowners insurance. And I just got this from the insurance company saying that that premium is going up to $1,100 a month. And then he just sat there and he said, I just feel like the walls are closing in around on me. So, you know, big sis steps in. I said, hey, give me the bill. Let me look at it. And, you know, then he launched into what, you know, where I knew where he was going. And it was true, you know, this international communist scum that want to end private property and, you know, blah, blah. But, you know, I was going to go into action. So I took the bill and I called the broker and I said, hey, just got this bill here and they want to make the premium, well, it's almost triple what it was. And I said, so we've been paying $450 a month and now they want, you know, they want $1,100 a month. And he said, oh, well, that's not good. Well, no, no, nope, it's not. So he tells me that nothing can be done until 30 days out. You know, they can't quote until it's 30 days out. So I report back to my brother. I said, well, let's not worry about it. We can't do anything now anyway. So we'll really dive into this in a couple of weeks when we can. And, you know, he was still, you know, really shocked and bummed out about this. And he's, you know, oh, they just want to take away your ad. I said, well, we know this. We know that that's the plan. It's the end of private property. It's the end of the middle class or the lower middle class or whatever. But it is true. It's shocking because we have seen the property tax just about triple, and now the homeowner's insurance, and it is just, you know, but this is the plan, this is the agenda. And so I try to take it back, you know, obviously we have to keep looking for solutions, and we have to keep sitting down as we do once a week and say, okay, what do we do and how do we approach this? But the thing that I try to keep front and center in my mind is I've got this work to do, this work on behalf of Alan and Alan's legacy and Alan's words, and I must keep in my mind that it is really important for me to keep going. It is important that I, that in the face of what just seems like overwhelming bad news and things that I don't know how I manage, and I don't know how to take care of this, and I'm not sure what to do, and where do I go next, and how do I approach this, and how do I get consistent money coming in, and, you know, all of this, is that I have to keep taking that step back and say, you know, the part that I just read to you about, or maybe I didn't read it. I failed to read the paragraph above that. But Alan was talking about the great work, the service to society, scientific socialism. And he wrote, this would mean, for anyone who has studied it, the death of individuality, spontaneity, and personal creativity. On a much higher level, the completion of man is to be done scientifically. And so chaos must be unleashed within society so that new laws may be introduced. So they have to make a new system and a new you. And he put that in all caps. And then he went on to say, he knows this writer differs from others by realizing that humanity has never been free. So I'm free in my own mind, and really that is what matters. So I appreciate your support. But tying into the talk and going back to the letter that I received, we do live in a splintered world in which it can be so difficult to connect with people. And if you think maybe that your community or your tribe can be found online in a group because your own family is so dysfunctional, then people gravitate there, and they find that because most people have been scientifically indoctrinated to comply, to go along, to be the perfect citizen, and that means censoring you or bullying you, then that's what you encounter out there. And, you know, I do some things that, you know, I wonder about the merits sometimes if I put this energy into making a Christmas lunch. What's it all about, you know? What does it mean? But I think about Alan and I think about tradition. It means tradition. If I clipped the top off of a pine tree and stuck it in a coffee can with ashes, that is a nod to tradition. And some people might say, oh, it's paganism or it's this or it's that. But for sanity's sake, we do things because they have had or still have something that helps us tap into what it means to be human. And I didn't spend a ton of money. I got some candied ginger and a quart of cream. But, you know, probably for 2 weeks ahead of Christmas, I just did something, you know, pretty much every day. I made some homemade butternut squash soup with sage and rosemary that I grew. That's about the only thing I can grow well is herbs. And then I froze it. And I had some different... I had some good steak and salmon in the freezer, and I had that, and I made some a couple of different dessert bars, and I froze them, and I made some, I blanched some Brussels sprouts and sliced them up and blanched them and froze them, and then I made a scalloped potato and Brussels sprout gratin with cheese in it, and it was good. And, you know, so I just did a little at a time, what I could afford to do, what I could take the time to do, and then I got it all out and timed its execution, had something there for the vegetarians in the crowd. And we enjoyed it. And it was tradition, and it was also coming together of people that I know, whatever our differences are and whatever we disagree on, I understand that they will be there for me. And in this talk, Alan discusses how the state takes over. It steps in and takes the place of family. And there's really nobody that I can go to in my family and say, hey, you know, I need a few thousand to help me finish paying off the property tax, because we're all in the same boat, right? Yeah, the sinking ship of middle-class Americans. But we love each other, and I think that matters. And so going back into the digital world, what you have with this planned chaos and the it's a pretty good word, the atomization of society, is that you have people that don't feel connected to real humans. And they know that by engaging with AI and liking that, you know, to be engaged with AI, they understand what they're participating in. And yet the hostility, the censorship, the cold shoulder, or the bullying that they might encounter in a social media setting is real. And it only contributes to this feeling of isolation and loneliness. And isolated and lonely people, well, this is Orwell's 1984, is it not? Big Brother talking directly to you. And I've seen this in social media settings of bullying, and, you know, the tough guy or the bully or the one who dominates the conversation. And I think a few different things. For me, one of the hallmarks of being an adult is the ability to control yourself. Self-control. And I also think of what Alan said in a talk I put up not that long ago, when he said, you know, one of the most important things, you know, the main thing that you want to do in this world is not cause harm. And that applies to face-to-face encounters, and it applies to the digital world as well. So there are a lot of, you know, tough guys, a lot of tough people out there who think they're some kind of digital warrior, and it makes anything that they say okay. And I have to say that this is modeled for us by the people that we have held up as oh so amazing. So one case in point here is what blew up on the weekend here with this thing called the H-1B visa. This is this visa that skilled, educated labor, of course, that's not who's coming in on the H-1B visa, but skilled, educated labor can come in on these types of visas. And so I think it's 7 out of 10 of them are coming from India, and then there's some coming in from China and then from other parts of the world. But there is obviously a lot of abuse there of skilled immigrants and many people coming in on these kind of visas that aren't skilled. Well, evidently on the weekend, Elon Musk tweeted something. The reason I'm in America, along with so many critical people who built SpaceX, Tesla, and hundreds of other companies that made America strong, is because of H-1B. Now, he goes on to say something kind of crude and profane. He said, take a big step back and F yourself in the face. I will go to war on this issue, the likes of which you cannot possibly comprehend. So I was looking it up. I thought, okay, let's find this. Ramaswamy. So Vivek Ramaswamy and Musk are, remember, these are Trump's Doge, Department of Government Efficiency. Oh, they're going to step in and make government efficient. And both of them have supported the H-1B visa. And so I was looking specifically in coverage like in Forbes or New York Times or just anybody. Did Musk really say that? Did he tell people to take a big step back and F yourself? So I just plugged that in to the search bar, and lo and behold, I found out that it's a line from a movie, Tropic Thunder, from 2008, called a satirical action comedy film, directed by Ben Stiller with Jack Black and Robert Downey Jr. And it looks terrible. Let's just say it looks really base and crude and awful. That line, take a big step back and F yourself in the face, is right out of that movie. So, you see, the whole thing is scripted. We should know who Elon Musk is. We should know that he comes from the technocracy lineage. We should know that he is really an actor playing a part. He couldn't possibly be tweeting all day long and running SpaceX and Tesla, et cetera, and partying and, doing chair dances with Trump. It's ridiculous. Now, Trump, who said, 8 years ago that he really wasn't, against, he said during his 2016 campaign, he called the program of the H-1B visas very bad and unfair to U.S. workers and tightened restrictions on H-1B applications. But now he's sided with Elon Musk in the feud. Yeah, he said he's in favor of the H-1B visa. Are we surprised? I mean, really, are we? And I've also pointed out to you, and I think this is important, that Vivek Ramaswamy is Brahmin, and his wife is Brahmin. And Brahmin is not just the ruling class, the priesthood, the highest of the four social classes in India. They are also warriors and traders and agriculturalists and physicians and so forth. And they are sometimes called, besides being the spiritual teachers, the guru class, and all of that, they're sometimes called masters. And sometimes they're called experts. Okay? So we are run by an expert class and a bunch of actors, near as I can tell. So I think we oughtn't to get too worked up about these things. And there was just one other thing in terms of understanding what it is that you are reading and why it might be put out there or what the spin on it might be. And this, I get little alerts from the Washington Post. There is no way that I would pay for a subscription to the Washington Post, that Jeff Bezos monstrosity of propaganda. But I do like to get notices of the propaganda so that I know how people are thinking. And this is a headline from the 28th of December. Baby in a dumpster, a spate of abandoned newborns unsettles Texas. Critics say these cases are no coincidence in a state with one of the nation's most restrictive abortion bans and near bottom rankings on women's health care. And I'm thinking, well, I live in Texas. I didn't know there was a spate of abandoned newborns that people were unsettled about. So I looked into this and I discovered that the whole spin of the story is, as I suspected, absolute rubbish. There have been abandoned babies hidden in bags, thrown in dumpsters, left out in the cold, and fortunately, many of them survive. But so many that in 2012, a full decade before the overturning of the federal stat law Roe versus Wade, which is being referred to in the Washington Post, Roe versus Wade is overturned in 2022. Texas, all of the decision about abortion is returned to the state, and Texas says it is not legal to perform an abortion unless it's a medical emergency. So the Washington Post spin is these women couldn't get an abortion and they dumped their baby in a dumpster. But what you find is that this has been going on for so long that in 2012, Texas passed a safe haven law, meaning that if a woman did not want her newborn baby, she could leave it in a safe place and she would not be charged for this. So this is the safe haven law in effect now for at least 12 years. And I think that it's just important to know when you read something, don't immediately go on to the emotive and don't go into the emotive reactionary stance on the article. Just listen, think, ask some questions for yourself. And one of the questions that I asked when I dug into this is, why does this seem to be centered around the Houston, Texas area? And one thought that occurred to me is that after Hurricane Katrina, there was a huge influx of displaced residents of New Orleans who ended up in Houston, Texas. As funnily enough, Alan mentioned Katrina in this talk. And so I think that when you have so many people that aren't born and raised in an area, that do not have a network of friends and family and, you know, social connections that go back generations, you might just have a feeling of helplessness that would prompt a mother to make a decision as this, as horrific as it is. So I think that's enough from me for tonight. I appreciate your support. I will say in closing, just remind you what Alan said. It's important to get through this world without causing harm. And when you censor someone or shadow ban someone, if you've got that kind of power, just because you don't like that, you know, that you don't like their point of view, or you think they're an idiot, or you treat someone poorly in a social media setting, you've caused harm. Just something to think about. We have a responsibility to know ourselves, to know what we're capable of, but we also have a responsibility to other people. And part of that responsibility is just basic human decency. There was a movie that Alan has mentioned to you a few times, really good, called Bonfire of the Vanities. Old movie, but worth seeing. And there's a judge, I'm blanking on the actor, you'd all recognize him. And he's got some chaos in the courtroom, and he stands up and gives them a lecture and about, you know, what would their grandmother think of this and blah, blah, blah. And then he said, why can't you just be decent? Just go home and be decent. And in the new year, maybe that's just something to do. All of us, in our own ways, are struggling. Everyone that I communicate with has, you know, not my problems, but they've got their own. And so we are all trying to get through this world, not cause any harm, hopefully try to help each other out. And so as we enter into the new year, maybe it's enough to just aim to be decent. So, as we say in Texas, y'all take care.
Hi, folks. This is Alan Watt at CuttingThroughTheMatrix.com. And today it is December the 27th, 2006.
All the leaves are brown, and the sky is gray.
we're watching the last of the year, the last few days of the year, with the final commercial stampede, with all the Boxing Day specials in the big cities, where the herd trample over each other to get all the goodies that they've been after for the last few months, just waiting and camping outside to get in for a cheap VCR or DVD player or something that's going to fall apart in the next few months. It's always interesting to when you live in the country, because you still, in this nice antiquated way, we take our garbage to the dump. And some of the better dumps, you know, the higher class dumps, you see, like the one outside Sudbury, they have a sort of booth there where they collect the better stuff that's been dumped. And they have tables laid out where you can pick bed bunks or whatever you happen to need and get them for $2 or $3. Sometimes you also get the VCR players too. I've never bought one, in fact, for years. I think I've got 5 downstairs. It cost me about $1 each. Most of them just need the heads cleaned, and there you have a decent player, as decent as you can get, new anyway. And that's where you find all the hard-earned stuff that put their money and their hopes into these rewards that end up in the garbage dump because they're either antiquated or they're just bored with them. It's a funny thing to hear when people say they're bored with something. It used to be just a womanly thing with her clothes. She'd get bored with them, or she'd worn them too often, and she was afraid of criticism by her peers, at least in the upper classes. But now people actually get bored seeing the same. How can you get bored seeing the same TV set every day? You think you get bored with the programs that were on the TV? Or maybe that's the function of it. Maybe it destroys part of your brain, so you need some more stimulus or something, a higher resolution, to make you very, very resolute in your idea or the ideas that's programmed into you. But I think too that for Christmas time, for many, many people, it's a relief to have it over and done with, and the perfunctory meetings with family and in-laws, and the same old stories are repeated over and over, and people gorge themselves. It wouldn't be so bad in the times when food, especially good food, was scarce for most people. It perhaps had a function then, but today, in the time of plenty, it doesn't make much sense. So and we're glad that it's over. And Orion's belt, the three wise men have followed their little star into the horns of the moon on the longest night of upper winter. The nights should start getting longer for the sun, that is. Bit by bit, day by day. Hallelujah, of course, comes from Hal, the sun, the same name as a computer on 2001. And it means literally, hallelujah means the sun, the S-U-N, is risen. And thank goodness for that, we'll all be freezing a bit longer. And we'd all be profane, meaning we'd all be in the dark. Tonight I'd like to talk a little bit about what I talked about last week. I mentioned we would find more and more little reports coming out in different countries on the same theme of brain chipping the public as a form of conditioning us into the inevitability and perhaps the desirability of having this done to us. In Britain, because they're a little bit more arrogant, they're the old school. The ones who go to the old granite stone universities, as they like to call them, as opposed to the red brick universities for the working people, is the granite stone ones where you find they meet their contacts for their the rest of their life, because they'll all be involved in high finance, in politics and bureaucracies. And I've no doubt this particular reporter from The Guardian probably has been there because he's got the arrogance to match. He's very short-sighted too, because it doesn't dawn on him that once everyone's chipped, they won't need reporters. In fact, we won't need news of any kind, or propaganda, really, is what it is. And he'd be out of a job. But like most higher Masons, they're very short-sighted. They don't see past their own lives and to the effects on their own children. A very selfish attitude that "I'm all right, Jack" originated in Britain. This particular article appeared on December the 24th, 2006, and I got this from an email from one of our listeners. The reporter is Will Hutton, and that would be the Observer in London, no doubt. And this is what he says, and listen to the way that he says it. It has the arrogance of Huxley and the short-sightedness too, as I say, of people who don't really see the end of the story. He begins here, "When words fade, it is the great ideas and arguments that move the world on. John Maynard Keynes couldn't bear the practical men and women who forged economies and societies by getting their hands dirty and mocking the thinkers. All he said were, in truth, slaves to some intellectual, theorist or philosopher, usually dead, who had given them their lines. He was right. We need an intellectual compass to make sense of reality around us." Now, you can listen to the Masonic terms all through this blurb here. And John Maynard Keynes was no genius. He was put there by the big boys because they wanted him there. That's what his job was. And nothing is authorized in the system and alters it without permission from the top. And Maynard Keynes, if you read his writings, was one of the most arrogant people you could possibly meet. He said that he hated all tradition. He hated all forms that were written down by culture. And his job was to break them and destroy and trample on them. A man could not get away with that unless he was told his lines. And he followed them. To continue. "And yet the ideas that illuminate and change our lives are hard to spot amongst the turkeys. Arguments need not only to be insightful, but they have to be useful. After a year of reading, watching, and listening, here are five ideas that meet those criteria, all produced by people very much alive and kicking. There are five ideas, I think have moved humanity forward in 2006. YouTube and the new web community. Predictions that the net was going to change everything have proved wrong until now. So argues influential web guru Tim O'Reilly. Web 1.0 was the first phase when we used it as little more than a vast library and efficient messaging system. We surfed from website to website and sent me emails to each other. But now we are in the era of Web 2. A new architecture is emerging, which allows people to connect with each other in revolutionary ways. Hence blogging or YouTube, where users post and exchange videos they have taken themselves. The mushrooming of participative and enabling sites such as MySpace, Wikipedia, Skype, Flickr, Facebook, Second Life, and so on are all part of the same trend. This is but the precursor of Web 3, when the architecture will become yet more sophisticated. Search engines will no longer list data, they will answer your questions. Web3 will mean that the web becomes a permanent part of our consciousness, conversation, and cognition. Ultimately, a chip in our brain will connect us in real time to the entire web, adding immeasurably to the power of memory. Is your sales pitch for the schmucks. Immortality is on its way. They are going to give you immortality. If Web3 stretches the limits of the possible, inventor, entrepreneur, and author Ray Kurzweil goes into realms of apparent fantasy. Moore's Law, named after George Moore, co-founder of Intel, predicts that computing power will double every year. Kurzweil pushes the logic to its conclusion. Chip power is growing to so exponentially that by the late 2020s there will be sufficient cheap computing power to reproduce every single minute function of the brain, the human brain. Kurzweil sounds crazy, but his track record of predictions over 20 years has been eerily accurate. Maybe that's because he belongs to the think tank where all these authors get their marching orders from, because that's exactly how it's done. Machines and human beings, he argues, are on a convergent course. Machines will increasingly assume human characteristics and humans the facilities of machines. Kurzweil even dares to believe that via three hybrids, bioengineering, artificial intelligence, and new food, human beings will keep death at bay. Chips in our brains and bodies will freeze the aging process, and via their successors to Web3, ensure that everyone will be at the frontier of knowledge. Now, this is aimed really at the young Lawnmower Man movie type generation, who have been brought up with cartoons with their favorite characters having chips in them and having superpowers. You always give a sales pitch to make the schmucks want. That's the big thing about a con. The victim of the con must participate fully and want, in a sense, to be conned. We have the same people at the top, who've been talking about culling us off down to a manageable level of efficiency. And here they are giving the sales pitch that immortality is just going to be handed out to everyone. And I hope no one falls for that one. And now he continues with his Huxleyan sales pitch. Happiness is what counts. For two or three decades, economists and philosophers have questioned whether technology and rising wealth automatically mean greater well-being. They do it for us, you see. We don't participate, so we need philosophers and economists to do this for us. And what's economists doing in here, you see? There's your key right away. What's that got to do with it? In 2006, we finally realized that we were too inattentive to what makes us happy. A crucial step forward. My goodness, I wonder how much they paid them to come to this repetitive conclusion that they've been spilling to us since about the 1950s. Happiness is about earning the esteem of others, behaving ethically, contributing selflessly to human betterment, and assuaging the need to belong. We have finally understood it is not economic growth that delivers these results. It is the way we behave. It's interesting, even the Queen, you see, the British Commonwealth countries, we still get the Queen's blurb on Christmas. And scattered in there by her scriptwriters, you have the key words, and ethics was in there too, I think, and behavior, and a few other scattered words. And you can see how these coordinate, all these little blurbs in the newspapers, on the media, all coalesce together. They're all coming from the same source, because that's what guides our thinking for us. It's already been done for us. Our topics, our conclusions are even given to us. And as he says here, as I say, happiness is about earning the esteem of others. Is it really? Really? maybe amongst a certain class it is, and behaving ethically. Well, ethically is very vague because ethics keep changing. We have bioethic committees now that sprung up when the body part industry suddenly came on the go, and they were just suddenly there, you know. You had specialists in bioethics and genetics who would decide for us how far to take all this and how to get the public to go along with it without saying too much. That wasn't too difficult, mind you. And the need to belong. Well, belong to what? See, partly they're right there because in a tribal instinct, people want to belong to the tribe and be the same as the rest of the tribe as far as dress goes and codes go and so on. But today we have a small group, which is growing too, though, of people who are far more aware of the management techniques that we've all been accustomed to throughout our whole lives. And we know where it's going. We know we're being manipulated. And we don't want to belong to the ones we've left anymore. And we can't belong to them. In fact, we're strangers to them. And we are strangers to them. But we don't want to go along with the elite either. See, the elite have talked for years about giving themselves eternal life. That's all part of their great work, as they call it, for themselves. In their ancient religion, in books which were published in the 1700s for each other, because they were the only ones that could read then outside the priesthoods, they talked about this religion quite a lot, and how their spirits were different from the common spirits, you know, the common souls. We're just souls. We're poor old souls, actually. I've got boots like that. And they talk about how they have spirit and how they were a superior type that were sort of imprisoned here, or cast here, and how they created their first human bodies to inhabit through forcing by pure willpower the earthly materials to create the bodies, which still retain special powers, but by inbreeding with the commoners, they began to lose them, hence the need for genealogies and back to inbreeding again. That's what they used to give us as a story. No doubt to impress us and make us go, wow, because if they'd say they're special, even in a negative sort of way, and we believe it, then we're putting ourselves in an inferior position. And they've used these techniques from ancient times. You'll find the Ptolemies, for instance, Ptolemy, who was a general under Alexander, ended up sort of inheriting as part of the loot, Egypt. And traditionally in Egypt, you had to be descended from the pharaohs to get the job. So he had a dream with the permission of the priests that he'd bought off. And he told this to the priests, of course, and he kept his lines, read his lines well. And so the previous pharaoh's spirit came to him in a dream and said, "It's okay, old boy, you're really one of us." And that was good enough to get the job as top pharaoh. So they sell these ideas to the public that they're special and different. And after a few generations, people do believe they're gods, you see. And they tell us all kinds of fantastic things to make us believe it. And strangely enough, the more fantastic the story, as I've always found, the more people want to believe it, kind of like reptilians and stuff. So I'll continue with this Guardian talk. David Cameron caught the mood by saying that the object of the next Tory government, Tory is conservative over there, would be greater well-being. The Observer published Professor Richard Layard's depression report, arguing that because one in six of us suffers from anxiety or depression, no kidding, eh? The greatest contribution the government could make to promoting well-being is to prioritize improvement of mental health care. Now, here's your abuser going to promote your well-being, the government. The government, most people in Britain who were brought up in, you couldn't believe the socialistic bureaucratic system of Britain. It was Big Brother to the extreme, from school onwards. And here they are worried about your well-being. If most of the government disappeared, people would suddenly become very healthy, because it wouldn't be so darn anxious about not having enough money to pay all the things they'd have to pay to government, to keep an incredible bureaucracy living in a standard of living way above everybody else. You know, Hamilton gets whacked, Hamilton of the era of Washington, just after, gets whacked for making a statement. And he was a banking boy. And he said, it's sometimes better to have one king than a whole government of petty kings. Meaning he only had one to feed with his extravagances and his family. And sometimes you get a bad one in a generation, but the next one might be better. And it goes back and forth like that. Whereas with the government, you have all the sharks at the top looting the honey jar, because the only honey jar there is, the big pot, is from the taxpayer. It's the biggest pot there is on the planet. It's the biggest lotto, and they all want to get their hands into it. So it attracts that type who give themselves incredible pay raises every year. This is government for you. Completely corrupt and out of touch with, well, they're not out of touch, they're perfectly aware of what they're doing. And they're talking about anxiety and depression. Now, Huxley did the same thing. This is almost verbatim from Huxley. You can tell it's the same people that have consistently run this part of the agenda, who's told this guy what to say in his Guardian report. Because it hasn't changed. But what Huxley failed to say too is the system itself is what causes the anxiety and the depression. Because there's no security whatsoever in the system. It's not meant to keep you secure. The system is not there to serve you. It's there to control you and to fleece you. So when government's going to prioritize the improvement of mental health care, in doublespeak language, it means everyone is going to be tested continuously. And that's exactly what the president of the US said a couple of years ago. He wanted everyone to have psychological testing. Then they'll really know you inside out, you see. We're independent, stupid. This is the next part of the same blurb. For more than a decade, neoconservatives and eurosceptics have denounced every shackle on national sovereignty. Neoconservative is an interesting term, because it's written almost for the US, that term. When Margaret Thatcher came in, they were the progressive conservatives. That was when you first heard it. And then neoconservative crept into the US, because it's all coalesced together. It's all the same bunch, actually. And Eurosceptics have denounced every shackle on national sovereignty. And 2006 was the year they lost their self-confidence. Part of the story was an unfolding disaster in Iraq. Even the US began to accept that allies have uses. The news that the Iraq war could cost the US taxpayer as much as $2 trillion with no one to share the burden was immensely sobering. Here we go, economics again. But all wars boil down to the same thing. One of the central tenets of the Iraq study group set up by President Bush to review the US's options in Iraq was that the US would have to talk to Iran and Syria if it wanted to withdraw in good order from Iraq. In Britain, even Eurosceptics like the Tory leadership and acolytes of Gordon Brown began to make more soothing noises about the EU. Globalization makes countries more interdependent. These are the same buzzwords. Oh, wasn't it Lenin that said we shall win by slogans? You know, just repetition. You see, that's all it is. Perhaps after a decade of interference, there's about to be a great leap forward. Oh, there's your Masonic term again, the great leap forward. Building bridges and stuff. None of this matters if we fry. Oh, very, very clever. How witty. How witty. I can imagine them tittering in the Ivy League college he went to. Campaigners have been doggedly insisting for decades that the explosion of carbon particles in the atmosphere is associated with a rise in temperatures. But the combination of 2006 being the warmest year on record and a series of epic reports, notably Al Gore's book, his ghostwritten book, Al Gore, who's now in charge at the UN for this whole pollution thing, and film An Inconvenient Truth, meant that only conspiracy theorists, oh, conspiracy theorists, see, anyone who disagrees is now a conspiracy theorist. Mm-hmm. I like the part about Cons piracy, Cons, the priest's piracy. They love this. They love this terminology. Theo, you know, theorists could carry on believing that the Earth is not warming. There's not a mention of the fact that they stepped up this frame on a global level last year. There's never been so much smog coming down from the skies, this polymer stuff. And I get reports from all over the planet and the pictures, and they're just the same as the ones I take here. It was a beautifully presented argument that began to change the minds of Americans. There were dark arguments in 2006. Among them, a generalized fear of the foreign other. But the force of ideas expressed above will, I feel, carry us forward, and that is cause enough for celebration. Well, I hope he lines up to be the first for his chip. Because, as I say in Britain, once you've done it, you've had your chips. When I grew up, it was just fish and chips. And of course, the chip is called the chip because it's a Masonic term, because it's a chip off the old block. And the old block is that thing in the temple which they all go around in circles about. And you'll hear them telling each other, I've been round the block a few times, and a whole bunch of expressions, if you listen carefully. So there you have it, the same old mantra. Repetition, repetition. Same mantra for all the years I've been alive, and before I was born, because I've always known where they were going with this. And that's all it takes, is repetition, so that your father gets his opinions from the same source, repeating to him, and he gives them to you, and then you hear it in the world around you, and it becomes your opinion. And you think, well, yeah, how great. We're all so darned anxious and so worried about things. Let's just put brain chips in our heads. Why didn't we think of that before? Amazing, isn't it? Rather than say, what is it that causes people to be so anxious? What's wrong with the system? No, instead of looking at the economics and the governmental system, they bring in the economists to decide for us. How clever, eh? It's kind of like bringing in the mass murderer to find out why people kill others. No different at all. But this is the world in which we live. It's a completely managed economic system. Always been this way, actually. Well, at least for what they call the beginnings of civilization, which is their code term for their system. When the one way or another encouraged the masses to serve the few and to keep them in a standard and style of life way beyond anyone within the masses. Britain, as I say, is a classic example of this feudal system. It still came out of the feudal system. This whole class system with what was right and wrong and mind your place. And when I was growing up, you heard terms like that, mind your place. So much for equality. And all through the industrial era, people were dying like flies when they got herded off the land into the cities, by a law has been passed, and the dumping of foreign grain by another law put out by Lord Rothschild at the time, which all the small farmers under. Then they moved off into the cities, and the big manufacturing cities which were thrown up with all this almost cage-type dwellings for the people to live in, if you call it living. This mass exodus from the country to the city where they were managed, and labour was dirt cheap. That's part of the reason why they had to get them in, not just to man the factories. When you have an overabundance of labour, then the wages plummet and the profits go up dramatically. The carts which used to bring out the dead for plagues were used every day in those big cities around the working areas in the days of Benjamin Franklin and after him when he visited England. And they would just dump all the bodies because they were worked 16 hours a day minimum, men, women and children, to manufacture things, as Franklin said himself, like shoes, which they couldn't afford to buy themselves. And he watched factories empty out, shoe factories empty out, and sure enough, they all had bare feet. This was the great industrial age of Britain. Then, and they knew precisely how long it would last. We're dealing here with people who work in centuries and centuries ahead. And after World War II, immediately at the end of World War II, a bureaucracy was set up to manage the integration of Europe. That's now admitted to, and for 50 years lied to the public about it. Deny, deny, deny. And they also set up bureaucracies to deindustrialize, and bureaucracies that would handle the massive welfare system that would just keep the people barely ticking over as factory after factory closed and moved. We saw the same thing on a lesser scale in the United States and Canada in the 80s and through the 90s, mainly as an offshoot of GATT. And under the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, which is managed by a star chamber, by the way, the public have no input whatsoever. The taxpayers of North America funded every big name brand corporation to move to China. And under that agreement, the taxpayers paid for all presumed losses up until the time they would be up and in full production. Isn't that a sweet deal? And yet Joe Average, who lived through that period, suddenly saw things like Made in China appear on the shelves, and because the media made no deal about it whatsoever, didn't mention it, just like the trails in the sky, It never asked the questions as to why is this happening? Why are things getting made in China now? Years ago, I noticed that the universities in Canada were full of foreign students, mainly Chinese. And I thought, and I did inquire out of curiosity. I say I have curiosity about things. I said, why would there be why are we training communist students who are going back to China, our supposed arch enemy that's supposedly going to destroy us, according to all the propaganda that was fed during the Cold War? And after reading all the books by the communist leaders, at least ghostwritten for them, just like Al Gore's book here about the global warming, and I noticed that most of the students, these Chinese students, were going into engineering courses, and I thought, well, why? Because they don't have the big factories in China. and they've been doing this for 20-odd 30 years. Well, this was all in preparation for them taking over, because someone somewhere knew, and quite a few people obviously did, that one day all the factories were going to move to China. It was just the schmuck public who didn't know, and no one was going to tell them. But if you do a little bit of inquiring, it's amazing how you can come to the right conclusions long before anyone else does, especially when you're thinking for yourself and not waiting for a media to give your thoughts to you. I've said many times that domesticated animals are so inbred and domesticated, it means that they don't react to with their survival mechanisms to changes within their environment. That's the difference between wild animals, natural animals, and domesticated ones. They sense things, they watch anything that's different from their track that they go around every night on their journey, on their rounds, anything that's in the way or different, they'll stop and stare at it and look at it from 100 angles before they continue, if they continue. But humanity has lost the ability to discern for its own survival what's going on. And it's not until you tie it in with Arthur Koestler or Koestler and others who talked about lobotomizing chemically by biowarfare techniques, everyone except the elite, those who must guide the ship, must retain those abilities for survival, whereas the public won't need them anymore because the state is managing everything for them. That's happened with a lot of people, with most people. When you're continuously warned about major changes which will do with your primary needs, then you should really be concerned, very concerned, and active. Not jumping into the well-prepared opposition, which there always will be in this chessboard, but going off on your own tangent and not following leaders that are supplied to you. You see, if you look at the big Greek buildings, Parthenon and others, and look at all the pillars that hold up the roof structure, they're designed in such a way that if one pillar is removed, each one is weakened proportionally. You take away two pillars, and it's even more so, exponentially weakened with each one. And that is the game of the chessboard, same thing. Long before the first move is made in a particular area off the agenda, think tanks go through all possible reactions from the public and what types of groups would naturally form to oppose it. And they train people in advance and get them ready to be your leaders. Then they make the move, then the reaction comes, and suddenly the well-funded and well-trained leaders are there speaking for you. The leaders always take you on a dance, of a frenzied dance of terror, fear, and yet they say all the right things on your behalf at the same time. Yet, gradually and bit by bit, they'll bring you to compromise. And compromise, there's no such thing as a draw. When you have compromised on a major principle, you've actually given way. And that's your first pillar being weakened. it makes it easier for the next one to be brought down, and the next, and the next. Ancient sciences, well understood with the knowledge kept in archives, where the occasional worker for this great work is allowed access for a specific function, a task that this person will have to perform. Every knight has his task, you see. When Brzezinski first mentioned the internet, long before the public heard of it or had wind of it coming, he talked about this communication system linking everyone to everyone, and also did mention the fact that it would be much easier for those in power to keep track of everyone. And then through the takeover or the creation of the major sites, as the media had done before, they could shape your opinions and bring you into the same new culture. By giving you the new culture, they create culture, you see. It's not a difficult thing to do if you're the only people, a little group who are planning it, because Joe Average doesn't plan the future. Tribal societies don't plan the future generally, but you have peer people who do plan the future and how to not only alter culture, but how to destroy the old in good building terminology and create the new. And they called it the web for a very good reason, because you get stuck on a web. And isn't it interesting that the big ugly looking statue that's in the main hall at The Hague for the United Nations, it's a massive, you walk underneath it, it's a black widow spider. Odd symbol for these characters, they're very strange with their symbols. It shows you something within, if we can call it a mind, that differs from the ordinary human. And maybe that's what it is. When you take the humanity out of the human, what do you have? And underneath it, this metallic, black, cold-looking structure, there's actually eggs. It's going to lay, you see. So it's a web, and it's also a net. Now, a net you cast on the waters, and then you pull the drawstring when you're over enough fish, and they're caught in this pouch of netting. What do you do when you catch fish? Well, you eat them. What does a spider do when you're stuck on its web? These terms are not chosen blithely. They're chosen precisely. Just like language has been created to make it easier for them to shape your thoughts. So you have the web, and for the Americans, their main language alterationist, you might say, was Webster, Webster's Dictionary. The precision of the system staggers the mind until you realize, with unlimited financing and think tanks, countless think tanks working, always working on the future with its own little chessboard in its little area, it's not so difficult after all. Especially when they've created generations to believe in experts. You can't think for yourself, the expert knows best. The expert convinced women in the 1950s that the powdered milk you buy for babies' bottles was far superior than Mother Nature. Not only that, and here's the vain part, you see, which they knew would work It will help stop sagging breasts. And people believed it because it was repeated by doctors and experts. Even though the baby needs mother's milk to help its immune system develop. Very important part. Of course, they would say at the top, well, they just made a mistake, you see. And, well, it's strange they made the mistake after they talked about having to kill off people and they had meetings about it. And they talked about making people prone to disease and how could they possibly alter the human structure to make them more susceptible to disease. This has all been discussed. The real world, this one that this reporter I just mentioned, who has read his lines to us, really scripted by the same old school, the specialists in that particular area, didn't deviate from Huxley's talk at all. And as I say, didn't mention the causes of anxiety in this society. Because in this society, especially since they've broken down the family unit and even the village unit at one time, which was strong at one time, they've got to where they wanted to be, and that is where government can talk directly down to you, the individual, without anyone standing in its way. But it also means there's no one around to help you when you fall on hard times. They don't want interference. They want you to be at their mercy. And at one time, towns and villages would stand together and help each other. That was the human thing to do, always down through time. And yet we saw, when the hurricane hit New Orleans, or some say it was steered in, and which I'm more prone to think is probably true, we saw that people falling off their roofs into the water, and FEMA stopped neighbors from going to their aid. This is incredible that they got away with that, and people are missing the point. When you're forbidden to help someone or save their life, only the experts are allowed, you're in big trouble. Big trouble. So the monsters at the top create anxiety. They create a system where you feel unsafe, helpless, and most importantly, you feel alone. That's intentional. This is psychological warfare par excellence. All designed, all talked about, all discussed, and now implemented. If you fall in hard times today, your neighbors probably won't come to your aid. What they will do is advise you to go to the welfare office, pick a number, and become completely dehumanized and humiliated in the process. In Britain, it crept out eventually. This is the time of the 70s when they'd really deindustrialized, and then later Maggie Thatcher came in and talked about the welfare system and how a generation would never see work in their lifetime, so just get used to it. It came out that these concrete grey buildings with the battleship grey paint inside, where you took a number and sat down and waited and waited and waited, while these steely-eyed lobster creatures behind the desks, you know, the government civil servants, who are not very civil, would eventually call your name. The paint inside, even the paint, see, nothing is there by chance. Even the battleship grey they had found to be the most depressing colour. It causes a mental depression. That was chosen deliberately And I think it was a Man Alive expose talked about that. So it's not bad enough you've been kicked and you're down. They still try to put you off from claiming that to keep you alive. These pittances at the time they gave the people to keep them alive. They still try and put you off from coming in. That's how much these people who want to bring mental health care in to everyone, to manage your life for you, that's how much they care about you. These same people in charge, you see, have they had a change of heart? Maybe it's going to be a New Year's resolution and they're going to suddenly change and be human. But I rather doubt that. I rather doubt that. The agenda for the 21st century put out by the United Nations has to be read by everyone who's sentient and who still has a survival instinct left in them, because the whole agenda is pretty well stuck in there. The habitat areas, the controlled society, no private property, no cars, no vehicles, a more advanced type of Soviet system. You'll need passes to go anywhere. Mind you, with your brain chip, you wouldn't even need a pass. They'll just program you. Once that's done, you will no longer be you. It'll be sold as the most incredible thing since sliced bread. And all the youngsters will want it unless you warn them. Because once everyone has it, or enough have it, the big switch is pulled, and the real function will kick in. All society, down through this civilization system, is run by ritual. Rituals for everything, because when you study any tribe, at any time in history, they all have their natural developed rituals. And those who control us understand that, and they give us rituals. And they kept talking about virtual reality. The 5 points going on to the 6 points. V1, 6. You're left with a form of ritual. VI, ritual. The 6 will be the completion. And no more problems. Isn't it amazing that even the police ultimately won't be necessary, because no one can do anything wrong, even if they wanted to or could even think about doing it, which they won't be. So even they'll be out of a job. They'll be chipped like everyone else. In a step-by-step phase. But they'll have to show us little miracles at first, you see, to make it more appealing. And how Joe Bloggs here was suicidal, and now he's got a chip, and now he's as happy as a lark. He sings all day and works on a farm mucking out a buyer, just happy as a you-know-what and what. Because in his head, he's Moonraker. He's out in space somewhere, doing amazing things. And this is the sort of way it will be played to the public. And the control freaks will all be on board the pirate ship for controlling society and controlling their children until enough have the chip and the real purpose kicks in. Can you imagine the long, long-term planning all of this has taken? Intergenerationally. Just like building the ancient cathedrals or the Middle Age cathedrals of the big builders. Because wherever the civilization went, they had massive building projects. And then the introduction of money and taxation to pay for it all, which was just to get your labor back from you. And those cathedrals in Europe took generations, sometimes 5 to 7 generations of stonemasons to complete. And through wars and plagues and famines and everything else, the construction went on. Somehow the money always was found because they never changed their plans. They had their priorities in all eras and all times. Just like regardless if it costs $3 trillion for the takeover of the Middle East or at least Iraq, it doesn't matter because they just print it up anyway and pass a tab on to the taxpayer and take it back off union labor. That's all it is. That's all it is. It wouldn't matter if it was $20 trillion. And I'm sure $3 trillion is only a fraction of Halliburton's share in it all. That Hal again, hey, boy, that sunny boy. We live in a world far deeper than the one I'm talking about here. Multi-layered, scientifically designed. And the only science you really need to control people, really, up until now anyway, is simply the science of the mind. And the sciences that even the ancient Greeks talked about when it came to controlling people, manipulating people, using people, would put this little boy scout called Freud back into school because they were way beyond that in the understanding of human nature. Way beyond it. Some of it leaked out, some of it they couldn't quite grab all of it and stuff it into the archives for their own little secret agendas. But people should study it and find just how much they knew. They know they can count on every boy or every girl going through the same phases. Look at the marketing industries and see, they get taught this too, of course. They exploit children of any age group. It's a multi-billion dollar industry every year worldwide. The exploitation of even toddlers and how to manipulate them to demand what they want. And it's the same all down through life, through every age group, because they know what you'll be feeling at 20, what you'll want at 25, 30, 40, 50, 60, etc. Male and female, and have tailored for either and all those in between. Scientifically designed totalitarian system. Up until today, there has always been teachers of wisdom who could teach on a one-to-one basis. And that's why knowledge perhaps is here today. But we're approaching a time of the grand finale of this phase of it, where simply one-to-one isn't enough. Because time is running out for the generations. We'll talk about this and more on upcoming shows. I hope I won't keep you so long tonight, because I'm sure you're all getting over your excessive eating and some partying, I'm sure too, for some. And now we're into the reflective time, because we do go with the seasons, and the old year passes away with all that happened within it. The good times and the bad. So I wish you all the best. And for me and my dog Hamish, it's good night. And may your God, who's risen again, go with you.
I've been lately thinking about my life's time, all the things I've done, how it's been. And I can't help believing in my own mind. I know I'm gonna hate to see it end. Seen a lot of sunshine, slept out in the rain, spent a night or two all on my own. And I've known my lady's pleasures, had myself some friends, spent a time or two. I have to say it now, it's been a good life all in all. It's really fine to have a chance to hang around and lie there by the fire, watch the evening tire, while all my friends and my old lady sit and pass it right around. Talk of poems and prayers and promises, things that we believe in. How sweet it is to love someone, how right it is to care. How long it's been since yesterday, what about tomorrow, what about